Good evening and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art's program tonight, part of our Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. This program is funded by the Contemporary Arts Council of the Museum of Modern Art, and I want to thank them for their very generous support of this series. Tonight's program is entitled Icon Culture, Lingua Franca for a Global Culture. Bruce Mao was scheduled to join us tonight, but unfortunately is unable to be here due to a family emergency. We're delighted, though, that his partner in this discussion is, in fact, here, Matt Mullican. Matt will make a brief presentation about his work and then join me for a conversation, at the end of which we'll turn this over to you to ask any questions that you might have. As many of you may know, Matt was born in Santa Monica, California in 1951, currently lives and works in New York City. He received a BFA from the California Institute of Arts in 1974, and over the last several decades, his work has been shown extensively in galleries and museums in the United States, as well as elsewhere in the world. His work is also included in the permanent collection of many major museums, including the Museum of Modern Art, where he participated in a project show in 1989. His work is also at the Whitney, MoCA in Los Angeles, the Ludwig Museum, and the Pompidou. He has also completed a number of public and private commissions in the United States, Europe, Japan, and Canada, and he's currently participating and participated in the Whitney Biennial and in a show with John Baldessari, with whom he studied, at Tracy Williams here in New York. Matt's work uses icon signs and other nonverbal languages to explore and communicate about contemporary society and culture. For over three decades, he has been among this country's most consistently inventive and engaging artists. Please welcome Matt Mullican.
Okay, I have 20 minutes. I'm talking about what I do has become almost an art form in itself for me. To explain what I'm up to is a very important point. And I generally start with a board and talk about how things got started. And then I go to when you see me here, you'll see that I close my eyes a lot. I look at the ceiling. I look down, and it really is an attempt to access the information and to put it in some kind of logical order, because information doesn't come up in a logical order, and also these ideas don't come up in sequence. I have to make them into a sequence so you can understand them. They tend to come up much more randomly. Slides very quickly, and at the the interesting thing about slides is that that's an artificial memory. When you have a slide up there, I can look at it, and then my brain will say, "Oh, I remember," and I can pull from there. Whereas this is just me pulling it out from the air, and from my all the other times I've given this talk. At the very end is I have a very short bit of a performance I did in Zurich something like 5 years ago in a trance state, and it's at the very end of the performance. And in that sense, you get to see me look at myself. I've been replaced. So here I get to do it firsthand. Then I have slides, and then I'm in the. Then I look at myself inside. So I've really gone into the picture. And that's how it starts. When I went to CalArts, I did study with Baldessari and in a class called Post-Studio Art. I grew up in Santa Monica. Both my parents were artists. My father had an exhibition recently at the Gray Art Gallery. His name is Lee Mullican, and he was in San Francisco and in L.A. in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And an abstract painter, beautiful, beautiful work. And when I was at CalArts, the first body of work really had to do with color and light. I was very much interested in light patterns and defining the world as a series of light patterns. So if I'm looking at you and I tell you that all I see are light patterns, you cease to be living and you cease to be people. You just become a phenomenon separate from any kind of content. And I was saying that that's all my eye sees. And I did a series of works dealing with this, where I had projected light and reflected light. I put colors on the wall, and I changed the colors of the light coming onto them. So this was in 71, 72. Like, for instance, I did a performance where I laid color on the floor. I turned out the lights and tried to find all the colors in the dark. I was interested in how they were in the dark. And then the lights were on, and then I missed a lot of them, so I had gathered them up very quickly. But the point was is that I was trying to demonstrate that distance. Then very quickly, I was having a trip. This was Easter 73. I was going for a trip in the mountains behind CalArts near Santa Barbara, Ventura, and I had an idea for a piece, just out of the blue, one of those light bulb ideas. It's probably the light bulb idea I've had. Now, can I talk? Does this mic actually work, or do I have to speak into this mic?
Works really well.
This little one. I don't have to worry about this. Oh, great. Okay. So here we go. So the idea was, I had this quick little thing, and what it was a detail of a car's tire. And it was a car's tire that never existed. It was a fictional car. And the point is that what I was interested in is a detail of something that never existed. And I was interested in what was happening outside the frame. So who's driving the car? Where is the car going? What's the color of the car? What time of day is it? What's the make of the car? Are there any passengers in the car? I'm expanding on this fiction, and it's growing. Another one, and at the same time, not long after, I invented a studio with a clock and a calendar, and I put a stick figure inside, and that stick figure did a lot of different things. One of the basic things he did was to get a pin and to prick his finger, and I named him Glenn. I wanted to make a picture a real place. I wanted to prove that stick figures live lives, which is a ridiculous thing to prove because we all know they're not real. But what I was interested in was that place. I wasn't so much interested in the surface. I was interested in that place, trying to go into that place, into the picture. So you can say a picture it represents something that's three-dimensional, but in itself it's two-dimensional, and I wanted to go into the representation and to deal with the stick figure's pain, the pain that he feels inside there, because I could feel it, but I didn't know where it was. And in that sense, that's what I was after. So when he's pricking his finger, he does feel it, and I wanted to figure that out. So then one of the next things I did was I had a dead stick figure that I put in the with Glenn. I made it about 500 drawings of Glenn in doing all these. I went through a psychology book and a biology book, and I went into his bloodstream and his brain and his fingernails and his toes. But then I had this dead person, and I wanted to take a photograph of this of a cadaver to match the dead stick figure. And that led me to a whole series of works where a friend of mine was going to med school at Yale, and he had a cadaver, and the face was all wrapped up. And he told me that they had unwrapped the face, and at that point I should go up there because I wanted to do a performance with the cadaver. What I wanted to do with the cadaver was to cover his eyes, shout in his ear, put my hand in his mouth. I wanted to do to the cadaver what Glenn was doing to himself. I was very much interested in that projection of meaning, and I thought that with the cadaver, that is the absolute kind of point where we're aware of this kind of projection. And also, it crosses some lines. When I go into the space, he's on his stomach, and we turn him over, and his left arm falls off. I really had to put his arm back on. What I wanted to do was pinch that arm, and I was interested in how I felt pinching the cadaver's arm, and I did let go. I didn't want to hurt him. And when I slapped his face and when I put my hand in his mouth, it was an odd experience, and it was really a matter of dealing with the himness, not the itness. Because when you talk about the
difference between the subject of something, the material of something. This is when, this is the pinnacle of that idea. When you say that there's a sculpture made of marble and it's representing Lincoln, and you can say, well, it's Lincoln, and then it's marble, and it's both, and it's okay, and you know, and you can really kind of figure that all out. But when you have a cadaver, you can say it's a body and it's an individual. It's a person and it's a body, and the body has no life in it. And yet we are seeing life. That's what I was interested in, was the projection of the life that I gave to the cadaver. And so we called him an it. He looked sad. He looked poor. He looked like he was a drunk. He looked. It looked like it was made of stone. It was crusty. It was gray. So the himness, itness was just really right there. And so I managed to go there and deal with that. At the same time, this was in 73, I did a series of works where I was interested in cutting up comic books. And what I was doing with that is that I wanted to show details of a story that really have nothing to do with the story. So it wasn't, so if there's trees growing on a street in the picture, I would just cut those trees out and have that be the picture. Because if Superman is going through the air, I'm not so interested in Superman, but I'm interested in the air that he's going through. I'm interested in the quality of the rain that exists in the comic. I wanted to go into the picture, as I said. And so these were details from an imaginary universe or from a fictional reality. And I did a whole series of works where I cut out comics. And so I was just trying to get to that place. Another thing that I did was to... my dream life was very, very active. Like when you're dreaming, I was interested again in the tactile element of dreams, because you might say a dream is a purely pictorial reality. It's not really there, and yet it somehow resonates with there-ness. You're inside that place. And so I remember walking down a street, and as I was walking down the street, noticing, this is in a dream, the way the grass is growing between the cobblestones, and then making a right-hand turn and going up to a house, and there's a house, and opening up the door of that house, and as I see the door opening, I can see a little bit of the kitchen in the background, and then there's a front hallway and a library, and my brain, what it's doing is that it's acting as not only the architect, but the interior decorator of that house. And it's placing it in a temporal setting. It could be the 1940s, it could be the 1950s, but it's given all this information. And so I was very much interested in my dream life at the same time. This is all 73 that I'm dealing with right now. So it really is a matter of, I did a performance, one of the very first performances I did, where a friend of mine, Paul McMahon, had a picture. And I sat opposite that picture, and I put my mind's eye into the picture and walked inside it and walked inside. And when I walked inside, I was immediately 14 years old, and I climbed up this hill, and I looked down at it, and I was 14. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. My father was working on the site. It had rained that night, so it was a bit muddy. And all these givens came to the picture, and I talked for about 15 minutes going into that picture. And so again, it was about demonstrating this idea, not so much about the surface of something, but the interior, the place inside. So at this point, you could say that I had a drawing of a stick figure. And then I would have a comic book person here. And then I would have a photograph of a person here. And then I would have a stick figure just drawn on the wall without a frame. And then I would have a sign of a person, like a bathroom sign. And then I have a head and body, which is the greatly reduced version of the person, to the point of where if you put legs there, then it becomes a person. But then, and then here I have a circle, square, triangle. And so I call them all Glenn, you know. So Glenn, Glenn, Glenn. So when you're at, when you see the photograph, Glenn makes sense. It could be even a photograph of John Glenn. So when you say, or is someone you know is Glenn, no problem. You are absolutely, we're in agreement about what's going on. Then we go to the comic book, and I say, his name is Glenn. That's okay, too, because his name is Glenn. In the comic, you can see his name, and they talk about each other, and da-da-da. And then I have my stick figure Glenn, which is where we started. And then you have the stick figure unframed Glenn. And then when you go to the symbol, it gets weird. This area gets weird because the symbol represents all men and no singular man. It's abstract. It's godlike in that sense. It doesn't have. It's not an individual. When I place an individual into it, you become more aware of this projection. This kind of projection of meaning. Then if I have a head and body, and I say, that's my good friend Glenn, he's over there, and I'm talking to him, and he's 33 years old, he has blue eyes, brown eyes, and get into his detail. And then if you go to the point of the circle, square, triangle, then they've really split up. Glenn doesn't really exist. So I would say that this is the subject, and this is the object down here, and they're breaking apart. Now, if I was to get a pin and prick, like a la voodoo, every of these pictures, who feels the most pain? And in actually getting real pictures, you realize that the pain really exists, at least in asking the audience who feels the most pain, it's about here. This is too remote in one direction, and this is too remote in another. But right here, that transference occurs into an optimum effect. So I had this whole kind of chart, and it continued because I was making not only photographs, but videotapes and performance. Theater was over here. And, for instance, hypnosis. I started to work with hypnosis in the 70s, where I did a performance at the Kitchen Center in 77. And I hired a hypnotist and three actors to represent an individual's life from birth to death with details. And the audience, it was a very creepy thing because of how the actors were responding. They didn't know what they were responding to, and yet it was over the top. And I was accused of manipulating the actors into believing that they were in these really tough situations. There was a lot of crying and screaming, and it was a problem. And in doing that, I vowed, after that performance, I vowed that I would be the one to be hypnotized. I didn't want to be accused of being a fascist or being someone who's controlling people to believe that they felt certain things when they physically did not. So then that was the beginning of the performances in that sense. So then I have this whole thing going. At the same time, I invented a cosmology, which included... before I was born, I was on a conveyor belt, and then I was born into life, and then as I live my life, fate controls my life. He looks at me on a TV set. This is kind of crazy, and he controls my life. And then when I'm dying, the fate meets death, and they decide if I go up to heaven or down to hell. Simple thing. And this is my life. Both of these, the choosing my parents and fate's control panel, are things that I actually believed in as a child. They're very mechanistic, but they do answer the question, where was I before I was born, and why do things happen the way they do while I live my life? Why did I stub my toe? Why did I, why is that person doesn't like me? And it all had to do with fate. And then, and since I was involved with death, I had the personality of death meeting the personality of fate, this person, and to decide if I go up to heaven or go down to hell. Now, if you notice, this is a Y shape, and that is the same as the subject and the object that I was talking about when it was about those people and Glenn. So my heaven is not about a good, and my hell is not about bad. It's subject-object again. So you'll see that happening again and again. So in a way, I had this systems... Of heaven and hell and also I grew up in a house, in a good modernist house of the 60s and 40s, 50s. So both my parents collected anthropological objects. So I grew up with New Guinea house posts and Egyptian figures and Chinese scripts and Mexican objects and all this American Indian, Hopi, all this stuff. The house was filled with these objects as I was growing up. And in thinking about those objects when I was at CalArts, I realizing that not one of those objects was considered art when it was made. It was almost all considered medicine. Or it was, and then after medicine, it would be considered religious. But primarily, it was medicine. And so that's, in a way, what this is about. I've been doing this cosmology since then. I'm still working on it. I just finished a book and an exhibition having to do with going into details of the last incarnation of that. So then I had all of this stuff happening. I had my series, my artwork in this different passageways. I had film, photography, performance. I did music. I did dance. I had my cosmology. I was also taking photographs of where I was living. So I took photographs of my bathroom and my kitchen and my bedroom and the street outside of where I was living. This was in 73. But in all of this, there's distance. And this is something that I think I share with others of my generation, that I'm looking at the process with a certain amount of distance, and primarily I'm looking at myself. I'm looking at my psyche. So the hypnosis, you see that I'm freaking out, and I'm a voyeur of my own freaking out. And that is that distance is troubling, and it's endemic of, I think, of the contemporary condition. So then I had all this stuff, and then I thought, well, if I have a sign of a man, and it's on a sheet of typewriting paper, a la this or something, what about if I made a poster of that that was like 4 by 6 feet, and I put the man and I say Mullican Man on it? Or then I can say put it in a flag, and I have it in a big flag. And then, or if I could say I put it in stone, or I put it in a carpet, I put it in all these different, and it acts as a kind of adjective. The material acts as an adjective to transfer the meaning even more. So in a sense, this is media, and different kinds of media, and those will be explored with the slides. So let's go to the slides now. This is 78, this is 73, mostly 70 is what I'm talking about here. Okay, so this is my studio, and here you can see that these are colored, the color charts, and then I have all these drawings, and then the photography is up there, the stick figures, and at the very top is the real world, where you have my deodorant, my pimple cream, and my mail on the very top. And all of this is just a way of, and this is a demon, this is a soul being stretched between a demon and an angel, and that's death's cloak. And heads and bodies and so forth. Okay, next. And then we do it again. Oh, so this is a detail of, this is fictional landscape, and that's a drawing inside that picture of a detail of it. So it's about going into the picture and showing a detail of it. And there was a feeling that I had, that I was inside that, and I could go in there and do a drawing and show what that drawing is. It's a double generation. This is the cadaver's head, and putting my hand in his mouth and covering his eyes, shouting in his ear. And I have him up with a doll's head. I've done that lots. There's a doll's head and a cadaver's head together. And he's resting on a piece of wood. And I got into such trouble with my friends of my parents. This was really a sacrilegious thing to do. So that was not even an important person in the story. It was the background, and so his eventual death. It's interesting that, you know, I'm interested in the creation of life in pictures when we see it. So what's the first thing I do? I talk about the absence of life. Because if you talk about the absence of life, this is a doll. I made 3 dolls, and one was a body, one was a head and a body, and the third one was just a pillow, and I slept with them. So here you have the sign of the man. Now, if you were to separate the red from the rest of it and just saw it, you wouldn't know what it was, but you would know what it was when you see this. I'll explain that later. That's 2 head and bodies. It seemed to be the simplest way of decoding or codifying the human form. And again, of course, the subjective objective, the head is obviously the brain. This is a folded sheet of paper, and it's a head and body. And to say what it means, I just have the sign on the back. So what happens is if you don't know what it is, that tells you what it is, that it's a person. And I was interested in the fact that you don't have to know. People were saying that people think in words, in language. That's how we think. And I disagreed with that. So I was trying to understand meaning not with words, but with signs. And signs seem to be faster. So there's that progression. That's the hand, that's a bulletin board, that's the hand of the finger. So I was doing all these photographs, and that's another bulletin board. And the thing about the bulletin board is that it's the first art, I think, is curating, is gathering of images and of objects. And it's something that everybody does, and they don't think of it as art. They think, but you are representing your psyche, and you're representing your world in these and doing these. Friends of ours have, it's usually around the telephone for some reason. People put their pictures up. And you can really tell a lot. You can see the family, the grandparents, kids, parents, going to the zoo. Everything's there. And this is just involving my art and then things I've picked up off the street. This is the show at Hall Wall. So I started with the photographs, like in the chart. Then I had these drawings. There's death, and there's the entrance to hell, and choosing my parents. And using those subjects, using death as a subject was really problematic. Using fate and God and heaven, and I still get in trouble for using those that material. And I really wanted to use it because it was it is very powerful. I mean, it is what it is. It is the subjective, and it was, people thought it was kitschy, and it is, has that element of kitsch. But I was told that it was uncool, and I went for it. I was in this kind of very sterile environment of CalArts, and I wanted to go against it. I wanted to go against conceptual art. I wanted to go against minimalism. I was not so much interested. I mean, one can say that when you look at a Judd Box or an André Flore, and the minimalist point is that they are making great efforts, and I commend them, and I think it is some of the most beautiful work ever produced, but they're taking the psyche out of the object. And I am saying, not only am I'm saying that's all there is, the psyche. You can take it out, but there's still, you're replacing it with another bunch of content when you try to take it out. You can never take it out because we're alive, and we can't help it. And so the cosmology seemed to be the ultimate kind of projection. You know, God is the ultimate projection that we all are involved with. We pray and so forth. So I'm still involved with heaven and hell and all of that stuff. And I still get in trouble for it. I gave a lecture in an exhibition I had in Linz, and I had all these young conceptual art students, and they were fine with my work. They really were following it until I got to this room filled with the cosmology. And then they all kind of backed away a little bit. And, you know, because I was kind of I was turning into a spiritual new agey artist, and they were backing away. And then Peter Kogler, who was the teacher, said, "You are a conceptual artist, right, Matt?" "Yes." "This is all theoretical, right, Matt?" "Yes." "There's distance on this." But he didn't get them back. They were finished with me at that point, I felt. I still feel that way. And it is troubling. There are people that like some of my work and not other. The people that like the flags and hate the cosmology and vice versa. Again, it continues to the signs here, and then the signs used in context where you have patches and jewelry and flags and so forth. And then the signs break down into the head and body. See, there's the figure there. Now, if you take away that, I can't reach, but if you don't see that, you don't know what those are. But if you see that, immediately know those are legs, arms, head, and body. And the fact that that becomes the language that identifies the other things is really cool for me. That was really an interesting point. I was making fake packaging, and then there's heaven, sky, ground, and hell. This is, now we're just going to speed up. This is my first show, 1980, at Mary Boone, where I shrunk wrapped the posters to be to look like posters, but they're all paintings. They're all painting on paper. Again, the cosmology enters with the poster technology. Mulliken life and Mulliken death. And then in the early 80s, I started to make works in stained glass because they changed the subject again. That's the subjective language, world framed, world unframed, and elements. And this with the flag. Now, does someone have some keys they can loan? Do you have some keys on you? Does anybody have keys? Thank you. I'm going to demonstrate the five worlds in my work quickly. Okay, on the bottom you have the green key, the green. That's when there's an atomic frying pan. And this demonstrates what these five, they're in all my work, these five colors. And they represent the five parts. So if I put these keys into an atomic frying pan, they immediately, the plastic is evaporated. All the keys twist a little bit. And then slowly the softer metals melt, and then the harder metal melts. And then pretty much it's a puddle of metal. The keys have disappeared completely. And then eventually the keys, even the material disappears. It's vaporized. And that would be object without meaning. So if you can say that this object has no meaning, that there is actually a possibility, as the minimalists want, to get rid of meaning. Meaning doesn't exist. That would be in the green atomic frying pan area. Then you go into the blue area, which is the world unframed, the everyday world. That's where these keys were 10 minutes ago in this woman's purse or pocket. And where your own keys are right now. Just the consciousness of where your keys are. That would be the world unframed. That's in blue, and that's almost like the unconscious. That's when you're in the everyday, when you're just kind of living your life, using your keys, you're getting dressed, you're just on automatic. Then you go to the yellow area, and that's when the keys change pretty dramatically because they're no longer simply keys. They become symbolic. So, for instance, these keys, I can tell you, were Elvis's private keys to Graceland. And these were the keys that he used to open up all his door. He was paranoid. So he had every door in that house, he had to get from one room to the other, and he had to open a door and close it and lock himself behind. And these are his keys. They don't work anymore. There's not a door in the world that these keys would open. But they're at auction. And they are going to make a lot of money. These keys, Elvis's keys, are going to, they're at Christie's, and they're expected to bring at least $200,000. And they don't function. They have become symbolic. They have entered that picture. They have become the picture. They are only a picture. There's an object picture. And that's the middle. That's the art. That's the world framed. Above that is the black and white, which is language. That's me talking about keys, the word key, the symbol key, and that's the catalog photograph, or this idea of all the times that Elvis's keys are represented in print. That would be up there. The fact that people are saying, God, I wonder what Elvis's keys look like. You know, they're really into it. And then you go to the red area, and that's the fact that I hate keys. The reason I don't have keys on me is because I can't stand to have keys. I have more and more keys in my life. And the red is my relationship to keys. That means pictured keys, object keys. That is the red area. That's the subjective. And that red area is where the hypnosis is. That red area is where the cosmology is. That red area is when I'm working in with the hypnosis, what happens is that I am almost becoming autistic or schizophrenic, and it's the brain. It has to do with the brain. So those are the five areas, and you'll see it demonstrated quickly. Let me see here. So there's glass, and you see a cityscape based with those colors. So that's a city, and then the stained glass. That's in Valencia. And here's a carpet that was at the Hirshhorn, and we separated the two, so it's like a big game board. This is the world unframed sign that's in a street in Bath, England, made of bronze. This is a huge, this is a sculpture project, a Munster sculpture project in Munster, and this was done in 87. And it's big enough to give a lecture. I could walk on it and talk about it. This is a big rubbing called the Dallas Project, and a rubbing comes from the relief when you make a copy of it, and it has its own kind of that. These are all additive to the material. This is a computer. This is the show I did at the Modern, which is the virtual environment. And that really is, I could go into it, but it really had to do with entering the picture in another way, where you're actually, I've done it in a virtual environment with the French Ministry of Culture, and I'm actually with the VPL equipment, and I'm walking around inside that space. So it really is going to the subject. So you have the poster, the plotter drawing, the stills, you have the 3D, and the video. And what happens that most people think those are stills from the TV, and the poster is for the TV, that the TV, the animated the television image is primo in this context for people. This, and then this is after the computer, I started doing these things with these low walls. That's the MIT project. These are maps again, just like that little flag, except this map weighs 150 tons. This is at the Kröller-Müller Museum, and you could walk on it, and it is a solid object, to say the least. This is in flowers. This is in Antwerp. These are the flags. Again, it's the architecture of signs, you could say. And one of those flags fits into a regular suitcase. They become nothing. They're very, very light. It's just one sheet of nylon. This is at the Alexanderplatz train station. This is from above. You see those five worlds from above. This is Documenta 92. And then what happens is when you go into it, you are really into it. It becomes abstract. So it is like the idea of entering the logo. Like what you see again and again and again on TV and in movies is when you have the logo and you go into it and it becomes something else altogether. This is a piece where I had, this is in Zug, Switzerland. You see the little one over there with the signs and then the flat. And that's still up, but that has to do again with the five worlds. Now, what I did is I had all my charts are like that on flat, and then I had this idea, what if I made them on a ball so there's no up, down, left, right? And so this was a different way of making maps. And it's a very different brain. I have some at the Whitney in the biennial similar to this. It changes it. Then also at the Whitney, most recently, the hypnosis characters that I've been dealing with have actually started to be more creative, and we're now dealing with this weird drawing typeface that I get, which is similar to singing, and it's a very odd thing. This was at the Ludwig Museum, and here is the installation at the Ludwig, and that's a menu from a deli in L.A., and he's obsessed with the daily routine. He lives for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He loves to take a shower every single day. And the best part of breakfast and the best part of the whole day is the first cup of coffee. That is what he lives for, this character. And I call him that person. I don't call him Glenn. People said, why don't you call him Glenn? You know, it fits in with the early work. And then it doesn't function. So I call him that person. If I call it his work, then it gets godlike, and I didn't like that. But that person is anonymous. It's like that person, the cartoon character, just someone on the street. And in a way, he's totally, I recently did an interview with somebody in the trance state and was talking about my relationship to that person, and he is a how. He's not a what. He does things in a certain way, although he loves to work for truth and beauty. So love is a big deal for him, truth is a big deal for him, work is a big deal for him, and beauty is a super big deal. And that's none of those words exist in any other part of my work. So let's go to the video, and it'll be a quick little bit, and you'll see that guy in action, and he is something. So what happens is that this is again the red area, the subjective, and that and he is not. He has a lot of tics. Time to get to you know what. He's going to take a shower now. So the shower, and when he takes a shower, it's not such a good thing. Because he, I'll just fill you in, he does not want to go back to bed. He truly, this is the worst thing that he does not want. He wants to wake up. He does not want to go back to bed. He's taking a shower because he's trying to wake up. And he knows that he's getting sleepy, and so he's starting to freak. This is at the end of a performance that's lasting about an hour, and this was at the Kunsthalle Zurich. What? No urine here. No, it's not that kind of shower. He is trying to get away from, he doesn't want to go to bed. He really doesn't want to go to bed. So there is a kind of an infantile thing going here. He's trying to figure out how old he is. He swears a lot and he mimics popular media. See, I'm looking at myself. See, now has the water on him. He knows. He's like the Wicked Witch of the West. He knows he has to go to bed. I think he probably is. He is a ton of patterns is what he is. He is all the hows of how I do what I do without knowing what I'm doing.
Thank you.
Do I feel refreshed? I feel like $1 million. I feel so good. That's a sign. He's finished. He's the clapping of those shoes. He's out of there. This is the end of the performance. Okay, we can. That's it. Well, that was like 4 years ago. That was the Kunsthalle Zurich, wonderful institution, and that poor audience. When I was finished with that, I go back and I'm with the hypnotist, and he brings me out of the trance state. And it's taking longer and longer for me to actually come out after the while. Like when I did it at the Whitney, it took me almost 20 minutes before I came out. And that time when I did come out, everyone had left. And I didn't see the director of the museum, Beatrix Roof. She left. She was gone. And I didn't see her until dinner, like 45 minutes later. She had to deal with it too. Because the thing about it is that when you're going into the picture, there is an empathetic response. And when you see a performance like that live, you feel it. And it's troubling. It's embarrassing.
I mean, first of all, it's fascinating. I wanted to talk a lot about performance and hypnosis and your relationship to the objective and the subjective, and just watching you watch yourself creates a very strange and awkward sense for us. Mm-hmm. But I was watching you in terrible pain, him in terrible pain, but you were... You were at times smiling, anticipating.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about when you see yourself like that?
Well, it takes me a long time to get to that state where I can actually look at myself doing that. When I did it at the Ludwig Museum, I did it in the offices, and it was only for the camera. That's a funny thing. Just in the offices of the Ludwig. Well, in any case, when I came out, I didn't see that video for 5 days, and there are some performances I haven't seen yet. It takes a long time, and I actually do get nauseous. I get physically ill looking at it.
Do you remember
the
anything?
You remember everything. It's a mat A and a mat B. Mm-hmm. We're cohabiting. I am saying, God, look what you're doing. This is incredible. Wow, how do you get that noise going? So there's chatter in my head as he's doing his thing. So I am a passenger in my own kind of psyche, and that implies a distance. When you're a passenger in your own psyche, you're looking at it objectively or trying to, and in a way, that's the problem. I mean, that's the good thing, because when I talk to it's a Jungian analyst, this guy who does, he lives in Zurich. He is my hypnotist.
Does he do all of your?
He does all my European stuff, and then I have a someone else here.
And is there a difference? Do you feel differently? Is he different when he's brought under hypnosis
by different people? No. I think it's very much the same thing. Did I lose my mic?
But you have American hypnosis and European hypnosis.
Yeah. Yeah, because you know, it takes a time to get used to a person, and it's really a lot of trust. And I've worked with a lot of hypnotists over the years. They started back in the 70s, and it takes time. It's not something that I can immediately do. And I've worked with people that are doctors, and I've worked with people that are not doctors, and I much prefer doctors. I really do. Well, the thing is, like, Yeah, the subject. What was he to tell me? I didn't want to go to bed. That was basically it. I wanted to wake up. I didn't want to go to bed. That was the suggestion. Very wide open. A lot of stuff could happen. And there are trance states that he's put me under where there is almost no guidance at all. So I'm not a chicken and I'm not a baby. The first performances, I was a child. I was an infant. I was a 35-year-old. I was a woman. I was shopping. I was an old man, and you know, very specific. But now the most recent ones are very abstract.
Do you have schizophrenic people?
Yeah. It's the how. The how comes up, and it is the, and the how is, you might say, the brain, the schizzy. The schizzy element is the how. Well, I'm not even sure. I couldn't really. I mean, when I see the performance after I do it in, on tape, I will see signals. Like right now, I just recently noticed that when he takes those shoes out and he's clapping those shoes on the floor, he's basically telling everybody that he's leaving. He's saying, "I'm going," and so he does the shoe. And all, at the Whitney, I did the same thing. The last thing I did was to get my shoes, and I was rubbing them on the floor like this for the longest time, and I had no idea what I was doing. And then I left. I was gone. I was gone. I was just immediately out of there. And so that's what I was doing. So you can break down the performance in terms of days. It can be a, it could be like a performance can take 5-6 days, the subject of. So I'm going to sleep, I'm waking up, I'm going to sleep, I'm waking up. And how do you determine time? And it's codified. But I don't know, and I'm just slowly breaking the code.
But then you somehow bring it to an end. I mean, There is an end.
There's always an end. I mean, and how, and people say, so how do you know when it's finished? Well, you know, how do you know when anything is finished? How do you know when you're finishing a letter or when you're finishing a story or when you're finishing eating your dinner or whatever? I mean, there are certain codes that we follow. When the plate is empty, it's finished. Or when you, there's just an agreed, it's intuition, and there's an agreed upon an exhaustion, an exhaustive element is there. I'm just wiped out, and I'm tired, or I'm angry, I'm really pissed off, or somehow it just seems like a natural thing.
Does it take you a long time to recover from one of those performances?
It has. It depends on the hypnotist, and it depends on the situation. Sometimes that's really easy, and sometimes it's not.
The hypnotist, because it's difficult to come out of.
They take me out in about 10 minutes, and it's just like counting backwards, and that you're getting more and more awake, and you're going to love yourself when you get out of here, and you're going to be perfect, and you know they give you all these suggestions, and you come up, and then you're, you know, I'm pretty clean and clear, but no one else is. I mean, when I come, when I did this at the Tate Modern, and I come out, and it took me a while, but then I go upstairs, there's a cocktail party, and Tracy was there. And people wouldn't look at me. They truly would not look at me. I was going up to people trying to converse, and they wouldn't talk. They wouldn't look at me. It was like I had done something very embarrassing, and they were embarrassed for me, and they weren't sure how they felt about it, and they don't know why I did it really, but they felt something. That happened in Lisbon. I did a performance, and this person comes up to me and says, "I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't know what you're doing. I have no." They felt it, but they couldn't qualify it. They couldn't put it in no box. And that made them a little nervous.
And they saw you go under?
No one sees me go under. No, I do that beforehand. And I wouldn't want, and the hypnotists I work with, they cannot be on stage. They refuse. The guy says he cannot be on stage.
You know, you talk a lot about this issue of distance, which is also a spatial problem. And you mentioned at some point early on in your presentation about autism. Are you autistic?
It seems to be coming up more and more. And it could, they're going into this now. They're going into the brain. I would have to be, if I am a little bit, I don't know how they can tell. I guess it's a bunch of symptoms, and then they look at your brain and see, you know, what's happening with the temperature of your brain or something. I don't know. And they can tell if you're autistic there. But the things that have come up in the performances have been Tourette's, this kind of thing where I'm just going like this and I'll just do this forever, or compulsive, obsessive-compulsive behavior where I can't figure out where to put a glass. You know, what's the perfect place for me to put that glass? Well, it's not there. It's not there. It's not there, and I'll do this for like 10 minutes. And I'm kind of two people having a conversation back and forth and just kind of bantering. But the basic thing, or like for instance, one of the things he's done is to get a radio, and he's done it a bunch of times, and put it in a static and put it right to his ear and then start to play with the sound and his ear. and he's very tactile. He'll rub his head a lot, and he'll rub his eyes, and he'll rub his hands, and he's rubbed the floor. The sensation is very, it's not unlike psilocybin. It's a very druggy thing, and it's very tactile. And what it is, you might say, what I'm after is, because, you know, it's a sensational subject, hypnosis, because it's almost like carnival, a circus element to it. Oh, Matt Mullican on hypnosis, see the da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I've gotten in trouble for that, you know. But what I'm trying to do and what connects a lot of that work, and especially the project I did at the Modern, with the virtual place. When my son plays video games, his body is all over the place. He has no awareness of his body when he's doing it, but he is going down those ski slopes, he is racing that car, he is shooting at those guys, and his body is reacting to all of that stuff. And so I've had me in a trance state in relationship to the virtual state. Mm. I'm very much interested in that. In the fact that if you are projecting into pictures like Glenn or like the photograph, there's this thing called mirror neurons, that when you see somebody on stage, that your brain emulates their chemicals in their brain. You can't help but do it. And you do that with still pictures, you do that with paintings, you do that with any kind of sign or people that are around you. Your body is constantly in movement like this. When you consider what happens to your body when you're watching television with all of that stuff. Now, the most powerful is the theater. That's the most powerful because they're measuring the brain now. They couldn't do it before, but now they're like, you're all hooked up and they can see what happens. And what that person is, in a way, is the psyche of the projection. So it is Glenn. It's the icon brain. It's the brain that I become. It's a very cartoony person. He's not real. And he's desperate to become real. So he has to do with the representation and pictures. He's a pictured reality lived. He is living in a pictured reality. I saw Speed Racer, which I loved. And that's a cartoon reality. That's a picture. That's all velocity. It's all how. There's no what there. There's no subject, really, except for the sensation of movement. And in a sense, that's what he's like. He cannot really say anything about what he's up to. It's a funny thing. Because he's a how, not a what.
You keep that distance between him and you.
Well, it's like with the cadaver. It's funny, him and it. Mm-hmm. It looked gross, he looked sad. Well, this is very similar, him and me. And that creeps out students too. when I show my videos and I talk to some bunch of students and I said, you know, he's doing this, and they say, but he's you. How can you say he? And I do. And it's not theater. That's the way I feel.
You've spent a good part of a career constructing a cosmology, constructing a world through symbols, through performance. Do you live in the real world or a virtual world?
I live in the real world, and you know, I have two kids. They're 13. I'm married. I'm moving to Berlin for 4 years, and I have a loft downtown, which I'm dealing with. We have to sublet it, so I'm interviewing realtors. And, you know, that's all pretty real. But it's all fake as well. I mean, it's all signs that I'm dealing with. I'm shuffling signs around. And at the same time, when I'm in the elevator alone, and I have to go to the bathroom, because this is something my children and I share, because we have a very slow elevator, I will start dancing in that elevator, not unlike that person. And it is creepy because he is right underneath the surface. He is so there. And when you talk to a doctor, they say there's spillage. He will come into my psyche and I will come into his more and more.
And
this is troubling.
Yes, I would think so. I mean, so in that spillage, do you sense that as increasing? Is there more and more spillage?
No, yeah, it's coming up more. I mean, it's tough, it's tough. You know, as I get older, as I perform more and I talk more, I'm at ease here talking with you here about it. So clearly that's okay. But it's like, see how I'm closing my eyes right now? I mean, it's the tics are more frequent, you could say. That's the spillage. So it's not so much a problem with my mental health. I think it's more having to do with the collateral of how the body is expressing itself.
What was it like growing up the son of artists, and how did your
A great privilege. I mean, it was fantastic. I lived in Rome when I was 8, and I lived in Venezuela when I was 5, and I lived in Chile when I was 16. I remember going to Rothko shows in the mid-50s, and I remember seeing those Rothko paintings when I was 6 years old because of the two glows. That's something I could remember. And serving drinks in those contexts. And I knew Gordon Monteclark as an 8-year-old. And because his mother and my mother were best buddies, and so he grew up in the same kind of situation. And it's just I grew up in L.A. mostly, and I left L.A. for New York, so I wasn't my father's son. And then what would happen in the 80s and 90s, I would be sitting at a dinner, an opening dinner with someone with my father and a curator, and they'd just get it. They know both our work, and they just understood. They never put us together, which was fantastic. That they wouldn't. But my father told me that if he was my age, he would have become a conceptual artist as well. He had nothing invested in being a painter, except that he was one. He said he wanted to become the most avant-garde thing he could do at the time, which is what he became. And I had a similar impulse, of course.
Do you see your children becoming artists?
Well, they both say that. Because it's, you know, and then again, for instance, Julian Schnabel's kids and my kids are best buddies. I don't know Julian so well, although I knew him in the 80s because we showed in the same gallery, but we've now become reacquainted because our kids, independent of us, have become friends because they share that, you know, that art world kid thing.
You talk about being a conceptual artist, but it seems to me that an awful lot of your work is about a very direct kind of figuration in a way.
Yeah. Maybe the conceptual part comes in that distance. Maybe that's the determinant of what that is, because that distance could mean that, you know, because I do have distance on what I'm up to. I make a lot of paintings. I don't think I've ever been in a painting show. And I'm very rarely am I in group shows, generally because I have a whole thing on my own and that's just the way it, you know.
Yes, we'll go turn to some questions.
My sculptures and my paintings and in my drawings. Yeah.
Nature.
Well, you can kind of come up with any, you know, you can customize your colors.
I was just wondering about your,
Well, I think it has to do with the direct. I mean, I chose those colors for particular reasons. And it had to do with the sign, the nature of the sign. Mm-hmm. And without any flags, you could say, flag graphics, where it is primary. It is, I think those the flag graphic really comes out of identifiable references from a great distance. Yellow and black and red and white can be seen from the furthest distance. They're the strongest, you know, that's why you have red and white traffic signs and yellow and black at the airports and so forth. And I think that's the reason I use those primary colors. I mean, why they are, you know, black, white, and green. They're fantastic together. And what I find most interesting for me about that is that I've identified the colors with specific meanings and I've reused them again and again. And it's almost like color coding a la architecture a group of pictures.
Do those meanings change? In other words, once you fix a meaning in a color, have you now established a kind of point of reference, or is there slippage?
Well, what happens is that, you know, anything can be, if I say elements, world, unframed, world framed, sign, symbol, and subjective, they can all be in each other's worlds. They're just points of reference. I mean, you can say, I've kind of invented a game where people had to choose what fits in each area. And any object can fit in any area. So this glass of water can be in elements. This glass of water can be in design. This glass of water can be in the world unframed. This glass of water could be in, you know, or money or anything. And there was, this was in Brussels, and I couldn't do it. So I invented this game, and they were calling me up because they were desperate to have my, you know, I had huge arguments about where things should fit. And they wanted me to be the person that would actually say, I didn't help them at all. I couldn't. No, because it's up to them. They have to figure it out. And there is no figuring it out because they all apply. And so that's the spillage, and it's all over the place. And I'm learning about it as I, you know, the red was always empty. Always, when an empty room is red. The subjective was, you know, the cosmology was in it, but only now. The red is that state. When I'm doing all that stuff, that's the red area. So it is empty in the other sense. It's not a graphic sign. It's what I'm doing, what I'm feeling, has that subjectivity.
And obviously, it's a very private world. It's a world whose rules you make up. But you put that world into the public realm.
Well, you want to talk about your own life and the nature of life in general. I mean, hopefully our worlds are private, that we live. I'm trying to be real in a way. I'm trying to state what it is in a funny sense. I'm trying to be honest. The way a child is honest. You know, a lot of people think of my work as being very childlike, and it is. My cosmology is very simple. Everything's pretty simple, very direct. But hopefully, I think the more that I do this, I realize how complex it all is, and how fast our brains are working, and how deep they are. And we've been dumbed down. Media dumbs us down so badly. And I'm just trying to say that, okay, hopefully we should all have our personal heavens and hells, and we should deal with them, and we should all, you know, have, you know, think about eating dinner and, you know, step back from your life in a way. So it is personal, but it's funny because what I'm after is the opposite of I'm trying to come up with the general, but through the personal. It's a funny thing because I see myself very much following when I was going to CalArts. What do you do after Lawrence Wiener? I mean, I didn't know what to do. I had to follow him somehow. And how do you follow conceptual art? Because those were the gods when I was at school. They were the biggies. They were the ones. Lawrence Wiener, and then going to Carl Andre and Dan Graham and all these geniuses. And so what now? You know, everything's been reduced to hell. I mean, nothing exists now. On Kawar, the best one was Robert Barry. Everything I know, but at this moment, not thinking. Okay, so he is objectified thought, the absence of thought as an object, which is an amazing, that's an amazing piece. So what do you do after that? So then I just, it's the opposite. It's in a way, all that dirt that we can't help but project out there. And I'm dealing with subject matter that is personal. But it isn't. You know, I'm not talking about my love life. I'm not talking about my kids. I'm talking about, you know, subjects that have been in art since the beginning. I mean, I, the representation of heaven is in every culture, in every form. And when I talked about medicine, you know, there was a fun quote by Picasso. He said he felt that his work was primitive, that a really, really advanced picture could cure a toothache. And, you know, that's in a way where we come out of. That's where artists come out of somehow.
You know, there are a lot of people that would disagree with me, but you know, you could say that this is a very much a kind of what am I doing when I'm doing this? Where am I trying to go? Where am I trying to? What am I doing? I still don't know. You know, I'm demonstrating the subject.
Do you see yourself as shamanistic?
Towards what end? I mean, you know, of course I'm...
curing
a toothache. Yeah, well, I'm not. I'm not curing any toothache out there. I am attempting to... That was fun when I was at... I did this show. That was a show on the brain, and I gave a lecture with a neuroscientist, and we were talking together about the brain, and I was coming at it from this kind of unconscious, intuitive way that an artist approaches the subject, and he was coming from it from a person who's experimenting all the time and doing, and it was really a lot of fun to talk to him about it. So I am trying to get through myself.
You, yeah? You're
lonely?
I'm not
lonely. You know, if I do, you know, that distancing thing, it's a fairly romantic idea, and it could be real, although I have a wonderful family and, you know, I'm involved there. But when I was first going out with my wife, first dates, I sat her at a bar and we were talking, and I was talking to her about, you know, it's trouble. If you're involved with me, it's trouble. And there's distance and she told me later on she thought that I was trying to say that I was gay. That's what she was trying, but it's worse. I'm always looking. I'm always looking at the situation from someplace else. I cannot not do that. And I think that's the curse of being an artist, I think. The most famous example of that recently is Warhol. You know, where is he in relationship to all that was surrounding him? He was looking at it all. He was just watching. It was like he might have been anywhere and just looking. And in a way, I have that in me. And yet, I'm doing something that is so the opposite, because it's somehow dealing with the individual, the psyche. But there's distance there, and that's, as I said earlier, troubling.
Yeah. It sounds to me like, it sounds to me like what I've heard people say I've heard one person say who was very troubled as a young person and disassociated from that by separating and making a committee out of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then reintegrating it when he could later.
Could be. I mean, maybe something happened when I was six. I have no idea.
I'm not saying it facetiously, but I mean.
No, but I'm not kidding either. I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm still thinking about this. I'm trying to figure out.
When I talk to this person, it sounds just like I'm talking to you.
Okay. And for instance, when I was, I am myself learning disabled. Which
I just wanted to say one other thing. In between, I have two children, one of which adopted four kids, two of which are autistic, one that has Tourette's.
Uh-huh.
And that's another thing. I talk to them all the time, long distance. And there's a similarity there, even though it's not the same as what I was saying before. It's kind of like there's a group of things you are.
Yeah.
You're trying to integrate that.
I'm trying to articulate them.
Yeah, and integrate it.
Yeah,
you're getting closer.
Yeah, I don't think I'm trying to somehow. I think
you're
I'm just trying to articulate them. I'm trying to get that. Well, I'm not. I mean.
But maybe you'll lose it.
Lose what?
Lose the separation, the distance.
No. You know, when you see the performances. You know, I'm just turning up the volume. That's what I'm doing, in a way. Yeah, troubling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Troubled and fear. No, but I mean, fear comes from that. If you have a committee, you know, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
you got separated.
But I think I'm trying to understand the nature of the psyche in the abstract. I don't think it's so much about me, my life, although you could say, as you are, that maybe it's a lot more personal than I think. I think all I'm trying to do is I'm a modern artist, and the thing is that modernism, unlike postmodernism, is trying to get somewhere. I'm trying to get somewhere, and I don't know where it is I'm trying to go, but I definitely am digging.
You know, well, actually, let's pick that up for a moment, because you've shown with a lot of postmodernists. You've been
I mean, the postmodern is the distance, of course. But I am. I feel like that's why, you know, I'm an individual. Hopefully, we all are.
And do you have a sense? It's actually something we talked about a little bit before you started in with your presentation, and it sort of unfolded as you were talking. I mean, do you have a sense of where this is going? I mean, can you anticipate the next move, the next place that you're going to be?
One step at a time. I don't think, like right now, what I want to do is I have all of these. I think the next kind of important thing for myself that I want to do is I want to look at a lot of these videos, and I would like to decode them and to see how I put my shoes on and how I read the paper and actually put them together and see what kind of movements are coming up. And to really, it's like separating all those parts and just to look at it, to kind of insert certain distances into the whole project right now. But that's for an installation, you know. And it's funny. It always comes out with the body of work moves. And for instance, I'm just doing a show for Barcelona. It opens up next week, and I did approximately 130 drawings dealing with the details of the cosmology. And there's so much detail in there, and it's growing. The detail's coming out of it, and that's what's cool. It's like a machine that I've invented, this cosmology. And I didn't really go into this. I didn't really go into the new cosmology so much. But for instance, hell is the body, and the body, psyche, body. And hell shits out the bodies of the angels before birth. And I'm interested in the digestive system, because there's a demon pulling the soul into him, and he somehow is processing, I don't know how, but he's processing the individual into the mass. And then those bodies are reemerging, because in my cosmology, you go to heaven and you go to hell at the same time. You do both, and you circle around, and you're kind of like that. And I want to go into the details more and more and more. And then also the computer stuff, that's still going. And so there's always, I think it's having a good time, you know, and it's having fun. Like the project I did with Baldessari at Tracy's now, which I kind of invented a game where he sends me a picture, I react to it in some capacity, send my reaction back to him, and then he has to respond and send it back to me. And it has to have something with what you got. It can't just be anything, but there's a dialogue that's emerging. And halfway through it, I sent him a yellow tile, just a yellow tile in the mail. And he was kind of dumbstruck. He saw why I did it, and I did it for a reason, and he saw everything about why I did it, and I'm his old student, and I was giving him the tough project. He wasn't giving the tough project to me. I was giving it to him. And so then he said, let's quit the project now. Let's finish. I think that's a good place to end it. We can end with the yellow tile. And we had done like four pieces, and it's not going to even fill up the downstairs of Tracy's gallery. And I said, John, aren't you having a good time? And he said, yeah. And I said, isn't it fun? Isn't this great? He said, yeah, I'm having too good a time. We can't stop. And he got it.
because he realized that he was having fun and that this was, and in a way, that's what I'm up to. I'm having a good time here, and the complexity is rich, and it keeps me going. And to still be making work that I'm surprised by, in a way, he is that person has become much more important because he didn't fit. He didn't fit into my color scheme. I could say now that he's in the red area, but then beyond that, that's about it. He was like the pressure cooker. He's the steam coming out of the pressure cooker of the system. And it's turning into this whole other thing, and I'm really happy for that. But going back to John, it's fun, and I don't mean fun just in the ha ha sense. It's fun because it's engaging.
Other questions? Yes.
That you did?
Yeah, the menus. You know, he's coming from some... I mean, the cosmology and he do fit together. But the thing I can talk about why he's just into lunch and breakfast and dinner, this guy. And detail. And he loves to copy. He loves to copy. He can copy everything because he's worked... When he's copying, he's working and it gives him a reason to live in a way. He's lost. He doesn't know what to do. So when he's doing this, that's fantastic. And also, one of the things I want to do is I've been singing a lot in these performances, and I want to separate all my songs and make a kind of a CD out of the songs because they're weird. I mean, they're very strange, weird little bits, but the singing and how he, that's like writing. It's the same kind of response that I write. And the first time that I wrote with that exaggerated posture, that exaggerated, and why did I do that? And why it's so thin and how psychedelic it looks. And it's like, I just like this. You might as well just go like this. And then just go like this. And totally into calligraphy because it's not about so much about the meaning of the word, but the representation of meaning and how the body does that and how the body feels that, and that's the way the script comes up. So he also wrote down love songs. He's done many love songs because he loves love. Love is number one. That's it. In English. It's all in English. Yeah, in English. Love songs. And the songs he's... And one of his favorites was I've Got You Deep Inside of Me. You know this? Because his theory about love is that the first is between me and him. That's the first love. It's between us and our image of ourselves. Is how we see ourselves. And in a way... A lot of the combination of the two is another song, and then another one was Heat. It was about hot. I forgot what it was.
You had a question here.
I just wanted to know what inspired you to go into hypnosis.
In my chart that you saw where I had the photography, I had all the arts there, and you had the stick figure and the symbol, and then it goes and ends up in theater. And then I wanted to go beyond theater, which seemed to be a theater where the actor didn't know they were acting, but it was acting. And so I thought of hypnosis and that I could have the actor or myself put into a trance state to believe that they were, an 85-year-old woman, or I had myself. And I wanted to do it in an apartment. I never did it in an apartment in the West Village where people would come and see it, but I did it at the kitchen. Also, when I entered the picture, when I became 14 years old in the picture, and it's 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'm walking in there, that is a form of self-hypnosis. When you project into any situation, when you psych yourself up into doing anything, if you have to psych yourself up to take a test, you are getting yourself worked up, and you are controlling your psyche in a very not unlike a trance state, And so it just seemed, those were the first times I've used it. I did a book recently called That Person's Workbook. And I did an interview with the hypnotist in that book as a text. And we talked about those early pieces and how they really are having to do with the nature of hypnosis. So it goes back then.
There's a question over here.
It's sort of interesting to me that people have this need to
Well, it could also be like, for instance, I gave a lecture at the Pompidou, and this was in the 80s, and I was in a show called the Opera, the Morale, I don't know, it was a big show with a lot of artists, and I gave a talk, and the audience starts to qualify the work I was doing. You are this. You're this kind of person. You are that. You are something else. You're a painter. You're a cosmologist. But then again, you're doing an architect. I've been in more committees with more panels as an architect than as an artist, almost, because I represent buildings in my work. And the point is, at the end, at the middle, the curator that I was, Dennis Akaropoulos, got so pissed off. And he stood up and he says, first you say he's this, then you say he's this, then you say he's this, then you say he's this, and then you say he's this. And he went on and he went through the whole list of all the things that the audience was saying, because they were not being friendly. It was not a friendly situation. And he got really pissed off because they were just going through all of these different, and then you can still do that with the autism, if you call it that. I myself have theories. The thing about it is that when to talk about that person is very difficult for me. I have ideas, like for instance, the way I noticed about the shoes. I can talk about the rest of my work with clarity and with and also, but this guy, it's difficult because I become the sign and I lose bearing. Like if I picture myself in a car in the desert traveling at 85 miles an hour, when I picture myself in the car, I'm not in the car. I'm outside the car about 30 feet off the ground traveling with the car like a camera. And I see myself there. But he's in the, when I'm him, I'm actually behind the wheel and I don't know where I am. I'm driving, but I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I look like. My references are very complex. Because they're firsthand, and he will start. I mean, he just you start going into this, you know, immediately. The hand starts to go like this, and it's a funny. It's hard to put it together. Yeah, but that's why it's like that. I that's why I'm drawn to it in a way, right? Mm-hmm. As any artist should be or would be.
Last question anywhere? Yes.
Does it relate in any way to Dada performance, you think, to Kirk Schwitters and Bert
Spouse? Well, it's a different time, and of course it does. I mean, I think all performance, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, and it also refers directly to, say, Vito Acconci and Bruce Nauman and to so much. I mean, you know, Merce Cunningham and John Cage and I mean, you have this sense of how it could function. It's funny, the performance part of my work, the only time I had a real sense of how it could be like was that first performance when I hired the hypnotist and the three actors to actually represent a woman's life from birth to death. And the three actors was an American Indian, an incredibly effeminate male, and a woman who was so in the middle of being African American and Anglo, right in the center. You couldn't tell. It was really back and forth. So I had all these weird people, all in between, and they acted out this life. And at the end of that performance, it felt like some kind of psychodrama, like but a psychodrama played out in front of an audience instead of gladiators. And you know, and then so, but it because it was all fiction, not fiction, but it was, it was craziness, but it was it didn't have anything to do. There were no real tables and beds and stuff like that. But here we are with reality TV, and it's. I watched New York Housewives, and I couldn't believe it. And it's but the kind of the obsession that occurs in that kind of context. So I think it has as much to do. I mean, it has to do with that. But of course, the Dadaist and I guess the big difference between myself and them is that they. They're monuments, and it was done 80 years ago, 90 years ago, something like this. And all of that work from that same period was so extraordinary. It's just a matter of seeing it clearly and understanding what they were after. I don't know that work very well, to be honest. I know much, my knowledge with conceptual performance of the 60s and 50s is much stronger.
Matt, thank you very much.